Welcome to Decades From Home, a podcast about Germany. I'm Nick Houghton of 40%German.com, and I'm joined by our man in the Nürnbergerland, Simon Maddox, and coming straight out of Bonn, stalwart producer Simon Josie, to discuss the weird and wonderful side of living in Germany. Hey, Simon. Hey, producer Simon.
Hello, gentlemen.
Good evening.
So, gents, speaking of the weird and wonderful side of Germany.
And we, in comparison to the articulate vileness and baseness and obscenity of all this jungle, we, in comparison to that enormous articulation, we only sound and look like badly pronounced and half-finished sentences out of a stupid suburban novel, a cheap novel. And we have to become humble in front of this overwhelming misery and overwhelming fornication, overwhelming growth, and overwhelming lack of order.
Although it's hard to replicate that unmistakable cadence of Werner Herzog, his words from the 1970s on the brutality and beauty of the Amazon jungle caught my attention over the weekend as I quietly doom-scrolled through the various distractions on Instagram, The Guardian, and everything apart from Twitter. Herzog's cadence, though, is really what makes that quote for me. It really is. I've watched it so many times recently. It's like he's speaking out of time, like a visitor from another period, appearing to speak in beautiful prose that sound almost rehearsed, even if they aren't. It's haunting in so many ways, I think. So, are we fans of Herzog's work, or have I just gone like full-on nerd alert? I like German cinema. I'm just trying too hard to integrate here, lads.
No, I'm a massive fan of Transformers, so McGee's my favorite. No. How could you not be a fan of Werner Herzog? Man, there's a lot, not just the cadence. I think the way he speaks, his mannerisms, the films he makes, his acting, like there's a lot to enjoy. And that's even before we talk about his influence on German cinema.
Mm.
Well, I thought he did very well in The Mandalorian.
I've not seen The Mandalorian, so you have to tell me. I'm aware that it's a Star Wars piece, but what is The Mandalorian? What does he do in it?
Is he a goodie or baddie? Actually, Nick'll know. Go on, come on, Nick. I know you're dying to jump in.
Isn't he some kind of gangster or something? I'll be honest with you. I watched The Mandalorian maybe a year ago, so I can't really remember off the top of my head. He's definitely not a good guy.
What I do remember, though, is when I was at university in my second year, I did a film paper, and one of the things we had to do was sit in the little AV library and watch Werner Herzog films on VHS cassettes, if you kids remember what they are. And I thought I'd never have to watch one of those films ever again. So, yeah.
Well, he's a funny guy as well, because he's massive influence on German cinema and like, is it like the new German cinema or new wave German cinema? So he obviously has a lot of influence on that side. But the other side is like he had like manifestos about film and like a real kind of semi-politicized perspective. One of the things I think about when, I don't know why, Werner Herzog and Giorgio Moroder are the two I always get them sort of mixed up in my mind because they sort of speak quite a similar way and they're working at quite a similar time and they're both kind of really influential on various different sort of German art forms and I don't know, I find that sort of period, that 70s and 80s period of filmmaking from Germany and kind of the art and culture that's coming out of Germany really interesting.
I think it shows like a really interesting part of German culture as well because I mean, reading more about it in preparation for this, I definitely stumbled across the idea often that German culture is, especially when it comes to like film and media, is generally quite lowbrow. And when you watch like German television shows, like we've all tried to integrate and watch these shows, and there's just so many like detective-based crime shows that are just, they could be replicated and redone in different regional dialects, different regional accents, different regional settings, and the narrative elements are just kind of so obvious in so many ways. And there's a lot of German TV that's just kind of like just standard and nice and middle of the road and kind of works for everyone. And then you have like this like upper echelon, like Wagnerian opera type, completely mm-hmm. disconnected from general population types of culture. And the gap between them is so enormous, and there's so little that even tries to bridge it. Whereas I think when you look at like the way that the BBC operates, because obviously mm-hmm. we all pay like a very expensive TV license fee here in Germany. And so you are paying for what's produced. And it does seem like the BBC, although the money it takes in is actually less than Germany's Rundfunkbetrag, they seem to produce better quality television in terms of like mass appeal and actual the quality on the screen. It seems like the budget feels bigger on a lot of these shows, even though it maybe isn't. Mm-hmm. And kind of Herzog, I don't know, it really seems like British people and American people, if you are into film especially, then like Herzog's like a really significant part of that. And again, there were so many comments where it's like, who? Who is Herzog? It's like, I don't know how people can get to the point where they write that on a Reddit. Like, what do you think of Herzog? They're just like, who? It's a really weird way of spending your time, I guess. But yeah, the lowbrow high culture stuff, and the fact that like it seems in so many ways that German cinema never really recovered from like the 30s and 40s. There's just not much there. But Herzog's one of the ones that really has pushed that envelope mm-hmm. in daring, like stupidly brave ways in so many ways. He didn't just like make films. He like went out into the jungle and made a film and just did it in a way that was risky, put genuine lives at risk. Lots of people wanted to kill each other figuratively and literally on his movies. It's, yeah.
Oh yeah, his work with Kinski is like renowned for like the, he was like waving guns in his face and stuff like that. He's like hyper violent. Kinski obviously having, we've talked about Kinski I think in the past. Mm. And his time there. But the I was in I can't remember where I was. I was in the, I think it's the birthplace of Fassbinder, the mm-hmm. The director who's sort of a contemporary along with Wim Wenders of Herzog. And it's one of these things where I was like, Fassbinder, like I know the name and I know the name of Wim Wenders, but like I couldn't like straight away name the kind of works or some of their films like just off the top of my head necessarily, whereas with Herzog it was like I knew at least six films that he'd done and I'd seen at least four of them.
He's done a lot. He really has done. His back catalogue is enormous.
Yeah, both the directors I've just mentioned, like seminal important like visionary kinds of people, but I think inside of Germany it feels like Fassbinder and at least has more cultural capital perhaps.
Mm.
Possibly because he died relatively young, sort of age 37, and so like maybe there's like that the kind of tragic element of the fact that he died from an overdose, but and Herzog just kept going. But I just feel like in Germany, Fassbinder is kind of seen like up here. Don't hear a lot of people talking about Werner Herzog as if he's almost like become an American director, mm-hmm. perhaps.
Yeah, I think there's probably truth to that, and there seems to be like a second wave of Herzog's importance with 2005's Grizzly Man. Mm-hmm. And when we first started talking about doing this, I said that you had to watch Grizzly Man and your reaction was, I've seen it once, I don't want to watch it again.
And I can't, the sequence, I think it's towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
It's the audio of the guy getting attacked by a bear.
So I guess, yeah, for anyone that hasn't seen it, it's a documentary that follows a guy who goes and lives in the bear backcountry. In Canada, and he is definitely not connected to reality in a way that most people are, and he believes that he is genuinely like living with the bears and does this for a long time without getting killed. But when you live with the bears long enough, I guess it's an inevitability that you will one day become lunch, and he does. And there is the clip that Nick mentions of Herzog listening to the audio because his death was recorded on camera with the cap on the lens, so there's no visual element, but you can hear this guy being eaten by a bear, which he loved. When Herzog's traumatized, you know that it's got to be a really ugly listen.
Yeah.
But that movie, that documentary, received huge acclaim, won loads of awards, and I think for a lot of people around our age who were like 2005, we were at university when that came out. Everyone I knew watched that at uni because it was just like, whoa, this is an insane documentary. And so I think a lot of people then who were our age kind of thought, who is Werner Herzog, watched some of his old stuff and then paid more attention to the stuff that came out. And since then, yeah, there have been more movies like Rescue Dawn came out in 2006 with Christian Bale. In a preparation for today, I watched Little Dieter Needs to Fly, which is the 1997 documentary about a German-American Navy pilot who was captured in Laos during the Vietnam War and held as a prisoner of war and eventually escaped months later. And that's the story that inspired Rescue Dawn. So that was like the remake. So Herzog made a documentary with Dieter, who goes to Laos and like retells his story of his captor with like Laos people being hired, like with AK-47s to stand near him and act like his prison guards. It's really weird. And then they remade Rescue Dawn, or they retold the story in a cinematic with Christian Bale in 06. I know, Nick, you did set us, well, we set each other homework, and you watched another one of his O series films. What did you watch?
I watched Bad Lieutenant. I'd seen it before, but I wanted to kind of catch up on it. I think this is the interesting thing about Herzog that maybe separates him slightly from, in fairness, I don't know a lot about Wim Wenders and Fassbinder's work outside of film, but you've got all the films that Herzog had done, then you've got operas, then you've got books that he's published. Mm-hmm. So there's like a range of different stuff. But the thing I think about with the films is, like, the first film I ever watched from Herzog was, is it Aguirre, The Wrath of God? Mm-hmm. And then I think I watched Fitzcarraldo because it was like a back-to-back thing on, I believe it was like BBC or something, like after the pub.
That's a tough back-to-back.
And I mean, they're brutal, but beautiful, like amazing films. I'd seen sort of Nosferatu and things like that as well in the past. And so these films that are kind of like the scale of them and there's like, and like, I mean, what's it? Is it? It's Fitzcarraldo where they're dragging a steamship over the mountains and this imagery and like, yeah.
They really did it in real life. It's bizarre.
Which is, I guess, why it was so fraught in that shoot. But you have these kind of, these amazing kind of filmy films. And then you get to Bad Lieutenant, which is like, what I've read about it as well. It's almost designed to be a little bit schlocky and a bit shit. And Nicolas Cage is the eponymous Bad Lieutenant. And it's sort of based on the Harvey Keitel movie of the same name, but apparently they changed, one of the reasons they, Herzog was concerned that it was like a ripoff. So they changed the name a little bit, but he just plays this detective on a massive bender / spiral into kind of oblivion, incredibly corrupt. And it's kind of like a little bit about sort of his attempts to, him being a massive scumbag, but also kind of not also a terribly awful person.
It's got exhibits in it as well.
Yeah.
Exhibits in it.
It's a little bit, but like I was reading on Wikipedia the development or production behind it. And one of the things that it was saying was that it was kind of designed almost to be a little bit ridiculous and a little bit overacted. And there's a discussion of it being like post-irony because it looks amazing, but it's got like a really like dodgy plot. The acting veers between bad exhibit and like ridiculous in Nicolas Cage. Like loads of sex, loads of drug use. It's like just a little bit insane. And then it also sits in a pantheon alongside, Fitzcarraldo. and as you mentioned, these amazing documentaries about these quite important topics. And then you also realize that his acting credits include Penguins of Madagascar. He plays a documentary filmmaker filming the penguins that are featuring the animated film Madagascar. He's in Jack Reacher as well. Okay. So we were talking yesterday about his guest appearance in Parks and Recreation as well. Yeah. So he like appears. I don't really know what box to put. Maybe that's the whole point. Herzog doesn't go in no box, you know.
It would be a very weird box for him to fit in. I'd say it's that range of enormously serious to like silly, and like the quote we played at the start, this does not sound like a man who does silly in any way, shape or form, but he does. I didn't realize until looking at the article, the entry for Bad Lieutenant, Wikipedia has it down as an American black comedy.
It's very funny. It's really, and I mean intentionally so in parts, but like also unintentionally funny. But again, it's like there's always another level with Herzog movies. There's either hidden depths or hidden levels, I think, to it that you just sort of, you have to appreciate. But like you said, that quote, I mean, the line that caught me, and it's the bit that I love in that blurb, is we only sound and look like badly pronounced and half finished sentences out of a stupid suburban novel. I'm like, God, it's like brutal. Like, but how is that the same guy that is, yeah, in Jack Reacher? Who knows?
One of the quote that stayed with me the most from Little Dieter Needs to Fly, right at the end of the movie, they talk about how he sort of took early retirement from the Navy, and then he went on to become a civilian test pilot, and that's what he did for a long time. And Herzog, as narrator, says this. He says, Dieter took an early retirement from the armed forces and became a civilian test pilot. He survived four more crashes and flies to this day. Death did not want him. And that has stayed with me since I watched the movie. Death did not want him. Beautifully creepy, poetic. And that's what Herzog, I think, does better than anyone. And yeah, like it's going to be in my Instagram saved folder for the rest of my life, I think. And every now and again, I'll click on that video of him stood in the jungle saying beautiful poetry while exclaiming that the world is chaotic and we are unfinished sentences.
And the Amazon's designed to kill us all. No, it's, and every time you look, you watch it, you have to send it to us. That's the rule.
Okay, deal. The weekly Instagram reel forwarding session.
Yeah. We don't know exactly what mental state you're in every time that pops up in the WhatsApp group.
It's either I'm doing really well or I'm doing really badly.
We have to guess. Easily one of the most picturesque parts of Germany can be found on the banks of Bavaria's mighty lake Tegernsee. However, despite the natural beauty, or possibly because of it, Tegernsee has become the second home to many of the richest people in the country. Some in Bavaria have even nicknamed the lake Lago di Bonzo, and Bonzo comes from the German der Bonze, meaning, and this is taken directly from the Duden, someone who enjoys the advantages of his position and does not care about the concerns of others, or a higher official who is alienated from the people. Interesting. I wonder who this is describing when we mention some of the people who live around Lago di Bonzo. The reputation of Tegernsee is perhaps less well known than its northern cousin, the wealthy playground island of Sylt in the north, which we've mentioned at least twice a year since the pandemic. But certainly here in Bayern, Tegernsee is shorthand for money and lots of it. There's also a really nice beer that comes out of Tegernsee as well.
It's a good drop. It's nice and really nice. It's a lovely one. Yeah, if you ever get a chance to pick one of those up, go for it every single time. I love this Bonzo, de Bonza. I'm going to be using that often. And so, I mean, my first instinct when I read that is Simon a Bonza? the advantages of his position as producer.
Doesn't care about the concerns of others. That sounds like our producer.
We're now going to be criticized for bullying you, Simon.
Yeah, I know, every
so
time.
So now you need to say something back.
Yeah. Fight.
I'd rather you just sat there and felt a bit uncomfortable with yourselves, you bullies.
Weird, producer Simon, that does sound like a higher official who's alienated from the people. Yeah, in fairness to our lovely producer, he doesn't live, or he has the decency not to live near the Tegernsee, although I can't account for his plans in the future. Who knows?
I'll do it out of spite, just to get you bastards.
Yeah. Spite relocation to Tegernsee.
I'll be honest with you, producer Simon, be bloody careful because you'll be closer to us and the more chance we might just, drop in. eat all the lovely food that your darling wife has cooked for you before you can get your hands on it.
Yeah, you could probably smell the roast lamb from where you live.
We were coming for the leftovers, mate. Well, yeah, so what do you guys know about the area? I mean, I'm assuming, obviously, you, Simon, have some sense of it. Producer Simon, did you have much sense of this area or what it means to people in Germany?
Well, I have a feeling my father went there in the late 60s. He spent 6 months living, with my mother actually, living here in Germany, just up the road in Köln. But I think he keeps telling me about this place that he went to in Bavaria that was really beautiful. And I have a feeling it might've been this place. So I will, when I next speak to him, I will check with that. So I actually may have quite a connection to the place and that my father may have spent a weekend there once.
perhaps that's why Bavaria infuriates so many people, because you just throw a stone and you find a beautiful part of the country surrounded by them. It's like a 2-minute walk from where I am, and I'm like, oh, it's some of the most beautiful countryside in the world. But yeah, it's for you, Simon. Did you have the sense of Tegernsee being this kind of luxury playground of the wealthy?
Yeah, I mean, it is, isn't it? It's so well placed for like a getaway from Munich. And of course, this is what a lot of the people who holiday there do in their non-holiday time. They live in Munich and get paid well. And so, yeah, it is definitely not your average spot in Bayern. One of the descriptions is laced with ski trails, toboggan runs and footpaths. I think if you're laced with anything like that, it shows that you are a pretty luxurious resort town. I mean, it is beautiful, no denying it, but it is also a little bit fancy for my tastes. You definitely feel like you're in a luxury region, and I'm not a huge fan of rubbing shoulders with people in gilets when I'm on holiday.
Yeah, I mean, you want to avoid those gilets. It's a good marker of the place that you might be inhabiting.
Shiny jackets.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people wearing boat shoes but not having a boat, that kind of thing.
Well, these people have boats. They're just not standing on their boat at the time.
They're just not in the boat at that moment. Their boat's too big for the lake. So the reason we're talking about the Tegernsee this week is the recent news that a luxury villa on the lake is currently on sale for 25 million euros. According to the Münchener Merkur, this makes it the most expensive house in Germany. So house prices and rent are obviously in the news because of the elections. But this is surely just a little bit nuts, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I grew up in one of the richest parts of England, and houses in my village would quite often go for 5 million quid, which is just an insane amount of money. For what was, for most people, a weekend retreat from London. 25 million is a whole different ballpark. This is like Beverly Hills. I was surprised when I saw that number being bandied around in the German press. It's a huge amount.
Yeah.
Needless to say.
It really is. And I think the sale itself is, and this is why a lot of media reporting on it, has actually shone a lot of light on the intentionally confusing world of wealth and real estate that seems to sit within this beautiful part of the country and its lakeside villages. In 2011, the 4,700 square meter villa was allegedly purchased through an offshore company on the British Isle of Man for some reason. Well, tax, usually. for 7.8 million euros. So in 2011, it was only 7.8 million. And though it is owned by this offshore company, the actual owner is none other than Russian oligarch and billionaire Alisher Usmanov.
Do we need to chuck a few more allegedlies in there just to make sure we're safe on this?
I mean, no, he's definitely an oligarch. He's definitely a billionaire.
Yeah.
He's definitely the owner.
The alleged actual owner.
It was really confusing, actually. The articles themselves were really reticent to just like say it outright. And there was only one that I found eventually that was like, nope, he's the owner. It's clearly he owns it. And obviously this is controversial because Usmanov is... Well, he's very litigious, so we do want to be careful what he has to say.
He's allegedly very litigious.
He's allegedly basically Putin's favorite oligarch, I think, is the allegedly. Nickname he was given. And he has gone off the newspapers who've said that, although I'm not entirely sure he's going to come after us. But even if he does, whatever, he can have my 20 pence in my pocket. So he left the country sharpish, obviously, with the outbreak of the war in Ukraine, and hasn't looked back, and is currently under... some sanctions from the EU, but he settled, I think it was a fine or a tax fine of some description with the German government, which was, I think amounted to something like 4 million euros. But now Usmanov is apparently trying to sell this place, or at least an agency or an administrator is trying to sell it. It's not entirely clear if like what connection Usmanov has with the sale, but he does claim that he rented the property for 77,000 euros per week. So he had this situation where an offshore company owned the house and he was paying what that offshore company 77,000 per week to live in the house, which is, I mean, it just sounds dodgy straight away, right? It just sounds a little bit suspect. So there's a company in the Isle of Man, which is a renowned tax haven, which has bought a house that a Russian oligarch is renting for 77,000 per week. Okay. He also claims to invested double-digit million sums in the renovation of the villa, which is possibly why it's got this astronomical price. According to the insolvency administrator Ulrich Kramer from Holzhausen, the villa has 735 square meters of living space, four bedrooms and bathrooms on the upper floor, a 20-meter-long pool, and a 750 square meter bathhouse. Well, isn't that nice?
I mean, that's the biggest bathhouse I've ever heard of. 750 square meters of bathhouse.
I'm not entirely sure what a bathhouse is, so there we go. It's a lovely story of oligarchs rubbing shoulders with, oh, hang on, let me check my notes. The likes of Philip Lahm live there, and one guy called Friedrich Merz, who has a holiday home there.
Who?
I'm not sure I've ever heard of him.
Sounds insignificant and not at all part of the modern political discussion.
Right? I'm just going to go back to the Duden's definition for de bonze. Somebody who enjoys the advantages of his position and does not care about the concerns of others. That sounds like a description of someone who might do some disastrous voting in the Bundestag last week. Anyway, we're not talking about politics, but that gives you a sense. But I like the idea that it's kind of funny, this idea that we've got at least like the great and good of Germany all kind of rubbing shoulders together. I like the idea that Philip Lahm is like living next door to Friedrich Merz. I wonder what they talk about.
I mean, yeah, Usmanov also has been heavily involved in the world of football. He was a major shareholder at Arsenal, and he was also involved with Everton and their stadium naming rights. So, yeah, this is a guy who likes football. So I imagine he probably really enjoys having German legends pop over for canapes and blinis and to discuss how to hide your income on the Isle of Man.
I'm sure Friedrich Merz wouldn't want to have those conversations. he's not the kind of guy. But it is. It really does feel like it's the true great and good of Germany living in this area. There's others as well. There's publishers, major business people, representatives of Hugo Boss, of Gazprom, obviously with Usmanov. what else do we have here? The former Focus editor-in-chief, Wolfram Weimer. Uli Hoeneß has a house there.
Of course Uli Hoeneß has a house there.
Thomas Stein, who was formerly of BMG Music.
Lorde Matthäus definitely has a house down there as well.
You would think so. He's not. He doesn't seem to be on the list. But I mean, in fairness, I get the suspicion that wherever in Bavaria that he is, everyone just opens their doors to him.
He's just got the key to the state. So he just gets to stay wherever he wants.
Like he just knocks on the door. Can I stay here? Yes, of course you can. Come in. Tell us about the World Cup. So there is a lot of different people. And it is a funny little story. The luxury villa itself will initially be offered discreetly as part of a secret sales marketing campaign. Not suspect at all.
Yeah.
Not suspect.
And that it features in almost every German newspaper.
Very discreet. Very discreet, very secret. This does mean that it'll probably not be traded publicly. So you, me, and producer Simon can't go thirds on it, I'm afraid.
We couldn't even afford the bathhouse, mate.
I don't think I can afford the door of the bathhouse. If Kramer is able to sell the house, he said that the proceeds will go into the account that I set up for the insolvency proceedings. Only I have access to it. Well, I guess we'll see, won't we?
Nobody who's ever said that has ever lied. Ever.
None of this sounds kosher. None of this sounds like on the level whatsoever. It all sounds pure dodge. A discussion that's come up more than once in the podcast is Germany's somewhat negative relationship with cars, and more specifically, speed. While producer Simon has argued in the past that Germans are some of the best drivers he's ever come across, I'm less than convinced, with every journey on the Autobahn seemingly designed to only ever reinforce my opinion. Now, though, it seems like I might have some evidence for my beliefs. The market town of Kirchzion near Munich recently reported that they had earned more than €1 million last year from a humble but seemingly well-visited speed trap. Since the speed camera was installed behind a local kindergarten about a year ago, a total of 34,000 speeding violations have been recorded. The majority of the violations involved vehicles that were between 6 and 10 kilometres over the permitted 50 kilometre an hour speed limit. However, 26 drivers were also recorded who were between 51 and 60 kilometres per hour too fast, and another 13 who were driving even faster than that. Bloody hell, this is right next to a kindergarten. Okay, it's not definitive proof, I know, But who the hell is speeding around these kindergartens? That's insane. Like, it's absolutely nuts. Who's like, oh, I'm going to go 140 kilometers an hour past this kindergarten? That's fine. That's okay.
I mean, this must be one of the richest places in the surrounds of Munich, because do you know how many people live in Kirchzion?
No, I don't.
10,764 people.
Yowza.
And so that equates to a revenue of €92 per person from the speed camera. So people are getting local payout. Everyone's getting nearly €100 a year just from this one camera in their little Dorf.
Well, that was what I was thinking. It's like, is it locals? And is it multiples of that 10,000 that make up the 35,500 speeding violations? And I imagine those ones that are sitting around 6 and 10 are probably locals. And all the other ones aren't locals. Because I can't imagine in a village of 10,000 that people are just summarily driving as fast as they fucking can past the kindergarten.
Looking at the map, it's basically the quickest way to get to Salzburg from Munich is along that route. So you'd go along the 304 is the name of the road, and that takes you down to Traunstein and all the way to Salzburg. So if you are wanting to go to the Chiemsee, for example, this is one of your ways you'd get there. So this seems like a lot of frantic Munich people going like, let's get to the Chiemsee, go to Salzburg, we're skiing, we need to get there rapido. And yeah, Kirchzion is benefiting to the tune of €100 per person on this one camera. Incredible.
It actually makes sense then, because if German drivers aren't that great to begin with, the Munich drivers are the worst of all the drivers in Germany. So it doesn't surprise me that it'll be Munich drivers driving absolutely ridiculous speeds.
I mean, this argument of who is the worst is definitely affected by the number plates, I think. Obviously, when I live in Nuremberg and I have the N Kennzeichen, number plate, and if you see someone with three letters, you think, okay, this person comes from a village somewhere nearby and you got to be careful of them. And if I see Munich ones, I do think, okay, they think they're better than us because they're from Munich and not from Nuremberg. My wife, who is from the Ruhrgebiet, I know that when she sees EN, which is Enneper, when she sees Enneper, like, she just red mist descends on her. She hates drivers from Enneper for lots of historic reasons. So I think it really is like who locally causes problems is the Kennzeichen. I think this is my issue with this whole system, because in the UK, obviously, we don't have any display of where the car is from. So if somebody drives badly in front of me, I don't go, bloody Munich person, whereas here I do.
You can know exactly where they're from. Yeah,
bloody Rot, Schwabach.
Well, I was thinking in Nuremberg, it's Lauf, right? L-R-U is the one that everyone seems to get animated about. It's, oh, God, it's some of them Lauf. They're awful.
No. Go back to the Pegnitz, you dickheads. Yeah. People do get quite emotional.
Like, and, which bit of the Pegnitz? I live on the Pegnitz.
Yeah, this is Lauf and the Pegnitz. although that is the home of Simon. Brauerei, one of my favorite beers, has my name. So I do have some love for Lauf und der Pegnitz.
Yeah, I get it. But yeah, everyone has their kind of most hated region of drivers for sure. And then usually it's like, is it an Italian driver or like the French drivers get, or the Dutch drivers get much worse? I think there's a lot more time for the Swiss and the Austrians.
I don't know. I do get a bit... I do get a bit agitated by the Swiss, because they're just like, they got nice cars and they get paid really well and they're down here. It's like, fuck off. When I see a Dutch person in a really nice car, like going full blast, I do get quite annoyed at that as well.
I only get annoyed if they flash their lights. Like, I get annoyed if people flash the lights, but if it's a car from like Switzerland, I'm like, oh no, we're definitely doing 140 past this truck. Like, I was doing 180, but we're now doing 140.
I assume this is a stationary speed camera, right? It's not a mobile one. So it's highly unlikely to be locals getting pinged by it repeatedly, at least. You get done once and then you know it's there and you always remember to drive calmly past or within the speed limit. So it's more than likely just getting that, as you say, Simon, that Munich to Austria traffic.
Yeah, it's a real money spinner. In fact, this isn't the first time this particular speed camera in this particular region has actually been in the news. It made national headlines when it was put into operation before Christmas 2023 because it caught over 3,000 speeders within a few days. And it brought in the municipality in that short period a record-breaking 100,000 euros in fines.
Happy Christmas. Jesus.
Come on, Kirk and Sion. What the hell is wrong with you? What is going on? Who hurt you? This is ridiculous. In fairness, maybe the people speeding are actually just really good Samaritans. The town's total administrative budget for 2023 amounts to around 24.3 million euros. With that in mind, a million euro windfall is actually a really significant addition. And this income, in fact, will be used to finance urgently needed measures, explained Mayor Jan Pierplau of the CSU. Among other things, the renovation of an indoor swimming pool and the elementary school in Egelharting district are on the agenda. So they're going to spend some money. It looks like a CSU member is going to spend some bloody money. Oh my God, that's exciting. They're probably going to spend it on a fountain, aren't they? They always do. There's every Bavarian village seems to desperately be searching for some kind of fountain. Either that, or I can possibly bet that they're going to save it for a rainy day. That'll be the other thing.
I mean, this place is pretty close to Munich. So if they do, they need to be careful not to build an indoor swimming pool that's too nice, because then more people will be speeding to the village to enjoy their luxury five-star resorts that they built with the ill-gotten gains of the speeding camera.
They're going to start building like a pleasure palace, aren't they? And just to attract all the worst elements of society.
It'd be the Vegas of Bavaria on the 304.
Oh no. That brings us to the end of the show. We're all off to Kurzion to, I don't know, give them 100,000 euros of our own money for speeding. Oh, that's not a great idea. If you're enjoying the podcast, why not give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, which only takes a minute and can really help us. You can also rate us on Spotify, so chuck some stars our way there as well. The podcast has accounts, of course, on Blue Sky and on Instagram, so feel free to follow us on your social media channel of choice. Just search for Decades From Home to find us. As ever, if you have any questions, feedback, or maybe an article or topic you'd like us to cover, reach out via any of our social media channels or get us on decadesfromhome@gmail.com. If you have the time, take a look at 40%german.com, where weekly articles are up every Saturday. All that's left to say is thanks, and bis zum nächsten Mal. Tschüss!
Tschüss!
Ciao!